but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Well, the men's Final Four in Phoenix, or more specifically Glendale, Arizona, coming up this weekend. But there's a whole bunch of festivities going on in front of the Final Four and during the Final Four. We'll be all over it. Men's and women's tournaments. Brian Svensson operates a company known as Pure Focus Sports. They dabble in representation of college coaches and basketball coaches and do a whole bunch of events. He's on site in the Final Four footprint. He's going to talk to us a little bit about the coaching carousel and what's the scene there. I know the games haven't started, Ryan, but what is the scene there?
Yeah, you know, John, it's actually a day early. So most of the college coaches roll in Wednesday night, Thursday morning, typically. The big National Basketball Coaches Association convention starts tomorrow morning. And so that's kind of, tomorrow's kind of, Thursday's kind of the day where it all starts rolling. And then usually you get fans that start rolling in Thursday and Friday, too. And it's a cool scene. I'll say this, you know, Phoenix is great. Weather's great. Everything's kind of spread out. So the best Final Four spots, if you're just a layperson wanting to go, probably New Orleans, San Antonio and India are probably my three favorite spots because you can walk to everything, you know.
Give us an idea, Ryan. Hey, Ryan, yeah. Give us an idea on the coaching convention front. Most of us have never attended a coaching convention. I've walked through it while the Final Four is going on. Give us an idea of what all these coaches are doing and talking about and thinking about as the Final Four that doesn't include most of them goes on.
Yeah, so you know, for young coaches, it's a kind of a networking opportunity. And so you know, you walk into the big pavilion, and there's all sorts of vendor booths. You know, I mean, all sorts of different technology, software stuff. You know, equipment. I mean, you name it, it's there. Tournaments that are out of the country, and you know, trying to recruit teams, they'll be there trying to recruit teams, and then. You know, it's really a networking deal for young coaches that are trying to, you know, maybe get a new job or break into the college ranks. And, you know, you'll see, like, tomorrow I can tell you that David Riley will be the most popular coach at the convention. Some of these guys that just got hired and just got a new job, you know, they'll be beating people away that are trying to, you know, get in their ear for a couple minutes and give them a resume and that kind of thing, because that's really where a lot of that stuff happens is at the convention. So, and then there's also a clinic. So in the convention hall, they'll have a court. Connor Sports will have a court set up. And I mean, I've heard, you know, Greg Popovich talk at these clinics in the past, and you name it, they get really high profile coaches that come and volunteer their time to share with college and high school coaches that are there in attendance. So if you're a basketball fan and you just love the game, it's a pretty cool atmosphere and environment.
One of the things I've noticed is you get a lot of athletic directors who are maybe looking for a coach now or might be looking for a coach in a year who will be at the coach's hotel meeting with people, talking with people. You know, what role will your company play in that regard as you move to represent some coaches?
Yeah, so you know, our client base is basically, you know, Division I assistants and then head coaches at lower levels that we think would have an opportunity to potentially be D1 coaches down the road. And yeah, so a lot of that is, you know, the networking piece of either introducing them to, you know, sometimes it's not even always the athletic director, John. It might be the assistant AD that is going to be the, you know, the assistant AD at Oregon that's going to turn into the AD at Santa Clara or, you know, Grand Canyon or, you know, just like coach, college coaches, you know, basketball coaches, they're looking for that next job too. So, you know, just really trying to network myself and then also our clients and get them in front of as many of those people that are in decision-making positions in different, you know, athletic offices around the country. And, yeah, you're right. There will be a lot of admin types there too, trying to, you know, get their list together for if they ever had an opening or if they got any job, who might they be looking at. And it's a great, there's no better networking opportunity in you know, modern day than the Final Four.
David Riley, you mentioned him. He's the new head coach at Washington State. You know, let's talk a little bit about David. Who is Washington State getting as a coach?
Yeah, you know, so David is a guy I've known for quite a while, and he's, the first thing is David is really, really smart. I mean, he's off the charts intelligent and, you know, has worked for some really good coaches and has had a lot of success as an assistant coach. And then, you know, when he took over at Eastern Washington when Shante left, you know, has had a lot of success and carried on the things that Shante got started there. So, you know, I think you're getting a guy that's really intelligent, a great offensive mind. His teams at Eastern Washington, you know, play a really fast pace. And, you know, when Shante left, he took a lot of guys with him. It was not, he didn't leave like a loaded roster for David, and David came in and was thought outside the box, has a lot of international connections and brought in a lot of foreign players and, you know, was selective in the portal and has done a great job. I mean, their best player this year started as his college career at Willamette University. So he's really been, you know, creative in how he's put together his roster, and I think he's going to have to do that again at Washington State. So, you know, in the old days of college basketball, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, that's probably a jump from the Big Sky to the, you know, to the Pac-12 is probably not one you would have seen. But given the current situation and where Washington State at, I think David's a good hire. You know, I told you when I was on a couple weeks ago that I thought Jim Chaw was the best choice, but you know, and I still think that. But I think David will do a really good job there, and he'll put together a good staff. And you know, I don't know if he'll save the current roster guys that are in the portal, but I think he'll replace them with guys that can play. And Washington State will remain competitive.
Ryan Svensson with us. He is in Arizona, where the men's Final Four will take place. Ryan, the Jim Shaw thing, you know, Washington State kind of moved quickly beyond him. Do you have a sense of why they were not interested in Shaw or what might have happened there?
Yeah, you know, I really haven't heard. I haven't had a chance. I haven't seen Jim. I imagine I'll run into him down here. You know, I think kind of a variety of factors. Sometimes when you've been an assistant your entire career, you sometimes get that label of, hey, he's a great assistant. And sometimes for admin, that can be hard to get past. Yeah, you know, Jim's got to be in his 60s too, so I'm thinking that his age probably didn't help him. You know, I'm sure at a certain point the Washington State administration is looking at, you know, kind of what they're facing in the next year or two, the uncertainty, and thinking, hey, we need a younger person with more energy to kind of bridge that gap for us. And, you know, Jim's personality is, he's kind of a peculiar guy, and I mean, great guy, smart guy, and a really good coach. But, you know, I could see maybe the worry that, hey, Jim's not going to win the press conference, you know, which sometimes I think administrators get too caught up in that. So, yeah, at the end of the day, you know, sometimes he's just not the right fit, and I have no doubt Jim's going to land on his feet and have his choice of, you know, really high-level assistant jobs here in the near future.
And that was really interesting, too, because some Washington fans were kind of hoping that Shaw would not get hired by Washington State, and, you know, Danny Sprinkles could add him to the Washington staff, maybe. You know, just weird how it works. Eric Reveno leaving Oregon State, going to Stanford. I saw that as a no-brainer move. I mean, Oregon State is... You go in to play a WCC schedule. Rev is getting to go home. Kyle Smith adding Reveno, a guy with some ACC experience. That just makes sense, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It checks a lot of boxes. I mean, first of all, Rev's a great post coach. And you know, Stanford has traditionally had, you know, quality big guys. And so having a guy that, you know, can coach that position and has had a lot of success helping big kids get better throughout his career, you know, on the court will have immediate impact. And then, yeah, just obviously with Rev's experience, you know, and being in the ACC at Georgia Tech, you know, being on the West Coast at a couple different stops, I mean, it's a no-brainer for both sides, I think. You know, and I think he'll do a great job there. He's a great fit at Stanford.
I also am looking at the, you know, and this applies to both the men's and women's programs. What do you sell, Ryan, if you're Scott Ruick at Oregon State or Wayne Tinkle at Oregon State or either of the Washington State coaches on the men's and women's side? What are you saying to your roster to hold them in place with the portal open right now?
That's a great question. I've actually been sitting here today kind of thinking that thought as I see the Oregon State kids on both men's and women's programs jumping into the portal. And, you know, it's a tough sell. And I feel, you know, I think both Scott and Wayne are just off the charts people and good coaches and, you know, great representatives of Oregon State and, you know, the athletic program, whether they've won enough games or not, that's besides the point. They've done it the right way. And to see those two and, you know, and then Washington State as well, you know, handcuffed so severely with the situation, I think the administration's put them in a real tough spot with, like, what's the plan? I get that there's uncertainty and, hey, we're kind of waiting to see what happens and is this lawsuit going to benefit us? And to me, if I'm the coach of one of those programs, I want to know what we're going to be and who we're going to be, and then we can sell that. And I think more than anything, you know, the biggest thing is the NIL collective Oregon State just not equipped to competitive with other Power Six programs. I mean, that's the reality. But then that uncertainty, like, it's hard to sell uncertainty to kids these days. You know, they want to know, you know, who are we going to play? What league are we going to be in? And how do I fit? You know, you're really not able, neither one of those guys can really sell that plan, that vision, that 3, 4, 5 year vision to families. And that's got to be a real tough spot to be in on.
Can you handicap the Final Four for us? I mean, look at, you know, UConn, Purdue, obviously, and certainly, you know, everybody's looking at UConn thinking that, you know, that is the team to beat. And on the other side of the equation, you've got Alabama and NC State that people are going, it's cool that they're there. Do you see a UConn-Purdue final, or could we get a surprise?
No, I think that's what we're going to see. I mean, I think, you know, college basketball is different than the NBA in that they still play through the post. And so, you know, Purdue, I mean, what Zach Edey did last week in that Elite Eight game, you know, against Tennessee was just remarkable. And I don't see them, somebody being able to stop him and enough to beat Purdue this, you know, on Saturday. And then UConn, I mean, they're playing at such a level. I don't know that UConn's on the list of, like, greatest college teams of all time. But I think modern day, when you think about their run and just how dominating they've been here in the first four games, I mean, I saw a statistic that they've trailed for less than 30 seconds in four games. I mean, that's, like, unheard of. I mean, at some point you'd lose the tip and the other team would score and, you know, maybe you miss your first couple of shots and you're behind, you know, 4-2 after a couple of minutes. Like, they've come out hot and they just put teams away. And I really can't see anybody beating them. I know if they, you know, get unbelievable foul trouble or injuries. I mean, they're the best offensive team. They're the best defensive team. They have the most depth. They've got all the pieces. And I don't even know that it's going to be real competitive in either one of their games. But, I mean, if I was a betting person, I'd bet an awful lot of money on UConn to be cutting down the nets on Monday night.
What are they doing? What, you know, give us the secret sauce at UConn, because it's not like he didn't lose players last year after winning a championship. He lost a ton of players, and he had to replenish. What's happening there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's really, really good, obviously. And their ability to run their offense, with they are so hard to guard. And they've obviously got really talented and really skilled players. But their pace in the half-court offense especially, and they'll play fast in the full court, but if you force them into a half-court game, I mean, they just grind and wear you out. But just the constant player and ball movement is not as good as I've ever seen. You know, so much of modern basketball is isolation and ball screen and, you know, guys, a lot of one-on-one basketball, and they don't play that way a lot. I mean, their player and ball movement is unbelievable, and it's really fun to watch. So I think offensively that's the biggest thing, is they're so hard to guard. Just because of that constant movement, it just puts so much pressure on you and wears you down when you're trying to guard that for 25, 30 seconds. And then defensively, they really get after it. I mean, they do a good job of funneling everything to the big guy. You know, he's an elite shot blocker. But I tell you what, it'll be very interesting to see if one of the, you know, traditional blue bloods that play in a bigger conference and maybe have some more financial resources. Don't throw a boatload of cash at Danny Hurley because he's really, really good. I mean, he's quickly turned into, you know, the top of that elite list of college basketball coaches that can kind of write his own play.
Yeah, I think, you know, given his dad's history with sort of the miracle of St. Anthony, and, you know, he might be happy. He might just be happy being at a place that, you know, he feels appreciated and has what he needs, obviously, to win. We're talking to Ryan Svensson, owner of Pure Focus Sports. He is in Phoenix area, Glendale, for the men's Final Four. You mentioned the company that builds the floors for the NCAA tournament. What a wild story that we had in Portland with the three-point line not being right. And, Ryan, we had yesterday on the show the attorney who noticed that the three-point lines weren't right. He came on the show. He talked about he was in the 300 level at Moda Center. He looked down and he was like, is anybody else noticing this? And, like, how crazy is that in your mind as a coach and a guy who's been around basketball that the lines weren't identical?
It's baffling, like completely baffling. And, you know, I saw a tweet or something on Sunday about it, and immediately, you know, I'm watching the game, and, I mean, immediately you look at it, you're like, oh, yeah, that's way off. Like, it's not even close. I mean, it wasn't like an inch. I mean, it was what, like 7, 8, 9 inches?
Nine inches at the apex, yeah.
Like, how did they play, right? How did they play Friday, Saturday, all those games? And nobody caught it. Like, it was so blatantly obvious. And maybe it made it easier because somebody had said, oh, hey, the line's off. But, geez, I paused it. I showed my wife. I said, she doesn't know anything about basketball. And she's looking at it going, oh, yeah, that's not right. So that I have never – I mean, I've done this 25 years, been around basketball and sports my whole life. I can't think of a crazier story. And so what Connor Sports is, and I'll see their booth tomorrow, what they do as both the men and the women's Final Four – it's like, you know, guys collect them, coaches collect them. You go to the convention, you go to their booth, and they have a little piece of floorboard that they give you as sort of a souvenir. It'll have the logo of, you know, this year's Final Four on it. And, you know, sometimes guys take them and get them autographed or give them to their kids or whatever. And it's kind of a memento and a keepsake. So I'm kind of curious to see what the reaction to the Connor Sports booth is this week here down in Phoenix.
I kind of wonder if they have one fewer employee, you know, like, because – apparently it was done in their factory and then, you know, it was shipped that way. But from a coaching perspective,
they make those courts. They're back in the Midwest somewhere, right? In Michigan or Wisconsin.
Michigan.
Or
Michigan. Yeah. Michigan. Where, yeah.
And then they design it, they build it. And then before it leaves their factory, they have a huge warehouse. So they actually lay it out like it's going to look, you know, at the Final Four or at the Elite Eight or wherever. And how they didn't catch it when it was all put together, I'm just like, I mean, it was so bad, so bad. Like, you're speechless. It's so bad.
How do you think that would change the game? Because on one end, it was 9 inches shorter at the apex only. The sides were right, but at the top of the key, it was 9 inches shorter. That affects spacing. That affects a lot of things that we don't think about. But how do you think that could negatively impact, like, a game you were coaching?
You know, I really don't think it impacted the game a whole lot. You know, I think if it had been further back, obviously that would have been a bigger impact, and not just from a, you know, shooting it from further distance, you know, piece, but a lot of offenses are set up based on, you know, the 3-point line. And so, what you find, you know, we run events at the Moda Center for high school teams every year. And what you find with high school teams is their offenses are negatively impacted because they set up based on the 3-point line. And when we run our events, we don't put a high school arc down. It's just the NBA line. And so you're setting up way, you know, way back from where you normally would. So I know it's, you know, it's embarrassing and it's like, geez, and what's going on. But as far as an impact on the actual game, I think it's minor. You know, I guess the advantage maybe would have been if the game had gone to overtime, and then how do you determine who gets to have the shorter arc for, you know, that extra 5 minutes? That might have been a deal breaker, but I don't really think from a coaching perspective and a player perspective, I think it's pretty minimal impact, to be honest.
Ryan, have a great time at the Final Four. Love to download with you afterwards, see kind of what the scuttlebutt is, and good luck to you, man.
Absolutely, John. Appreciate the time. Thanks.
There's Ryan Svensson. He will be there on the scene at the Final Four and the coaching convention and everything that goes along with it. Anna's popping into the studio. We'll play some Punch It audio coming up. You got the bald-faced truth statewide. Leave it here.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Anna's in the studio. Anna is in the studio. I'm only saying that because I want you to know that Anna's in the studio. Anna, how you doing? What's going on?
Okay. Hi.
Hey, you did something last night. You got me thinking about something.
Okay.
Steven, I want you to participate in this one so I stay out of trouble. But
we need a referee.
Last night, I happened to be flipping around TikTok, and I happened to my algorithm fed me for some reason 1980s songs. Okay.
Okay.
I don't know what part of your life, Stephen, was the most carefree, but in my world, it's arguable that the most carefree time of my life was like mid to late 1980s. Now, I made the mistake of saying to Anna that, you know, these songs I'm hearing from the 80s, because for me, songs and smells make you think about things.
Yeah.
I smell saltwater taffy. I'm immediately on the Santa Cruz Beach boardwalk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
I hear certain songs. You know, it could be like a Def Leppard song. And I hear a certain song, and suddenly I am somewhere else. I don't know what year it is. I don't know where you are as a listener right now. But I can tell you right now, there was a two-lane highway right by my parents' house that went from my parents' house to about a mile to the nearest stop sign. It's all I can do right now to not sing along with that song.
Same.
Okay. Where are you as Def Leppard is singing Pour Some Sugar on Me?
Like, I know exactly where I am.
Where are you?
That's one of those songs. I'm at outdoor school as a sixth grader.
Okay.
Not kidding.
I'm driving around.
Yeah, I know. You can do the math on our age difference.
Next topic.
I'm at outdoor school, and for whatever reason, one of the counselors at my outdoor school knew how to do like a laser light show that was synced to music. And so on the last night of outdoor school, it was like the counselors all let us go from cabin to cabin, and each counselor had like a shtick. And his shtick was to play that song at full volume with a laser light show against the wall of the cabin.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you're there.
That's exactly where I am
it
with that song.
It takes you somewhere. Yes. For me, it's a summer day. The windows are rolled down. I'm driving a 1977 Buick LeSabre. It was a two-door. That was the car I drove.
Hot ride.
It was not a hot ride.
Hey, baby.
It was a granny. And my parents did me a real service by putting me in like an old person's car.
Yeah.
Is my first vehicle. Those doors on that Buick LeSabre were so big, it was like pushing a blocking sled to close the door. Like I had to bend my knees. I had to get in an athletic stance. I had to do some things. Okay. So, you know, that song takes me somewhere. But it's not alone. I mean, there are other songs that like transport me places. And I'm just curious. Like, I said to you, gosh, these songs from the 1980s, they take me to a simpler time, a less complicated time. I can't remember the verbiage I used.
I remember the exact verbiage you used. It was, you know, you got real serious. This is what it's like living with you. You're eccentric.
Yeah.
So you come to the bedside and you're like, I used to be carefree. Like, there was no... There was no lead up, no on-ramp to this conversation. This
right.
is how it goes in this household. You just turn
I
me
just
out
start.
Of the blue. And you say, you know, I used to be carefree. And I look at you quizzically.
Yeah.
And you say, before I met you, before we had children, there was a time in my life when I was carefree.
100%.
I just looked at you like, I can't wait to see where this goes.
Wake me up before you go, go. Don't leave me hanging on like a yo-yo. Wake me up before you go, go. I don't want to miss it when you hit that high. Wake me up before you go, go.
There was a time in my life when George Michael was just kind of bebopping around, you know? And it was okay. There was nothing wrong with that, you know? I was having a good time. My 49ers were good. They were challenging for, you know, Super Bowl championships in this era. Joe Montana was still running around a field. I can remember distinctly that, you know, the World Series was often featured teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees and other teams. But it transports me somewhere. And I don't mean it as a slap. I'm not saying I would trade it, Anna. I'm not saying that, like, I don't like the responsibilities that I have today. But I can remember a time that was much simpler. It was just simpler. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself today, I thought, you know, how can I channel this?
Yeah.
And I was in the car earlier today and I threw on some of the music. You know, it does have a positive effect. Yeah. You can put on that old 80s music and it's not quite the 80s. You still see Teslas driving around and people cutting you off in traffic, transfer portals out there. All that complicated stuff of this era is out there. But I just kind of wonder, like, you know, if maybe we all need to kind of just pipe down a little bit, you know, like not be as serious as we all think we should be.
I think a lot of us find ways to do that. Like when you say that to me, like I used to be carefree. I feel like I am still carefree in moments of my day. Am I carefree for large chunks of my day? I'm not.
When the time when you come on the show, is it carefree?
Yeah, it's relatively carefree.
Mostly.
Unless you say something that pisses me off
right?
And then I walk off in a tantrum.
I don't mean it in a negative way. Like, I love what I do, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I love doing the radio show. I love writing. I love being a dad. I love being a husband. I love these things. Like, I love what I do.
Sure.
It just was a lot simpler when my worries were, where are my cleats? Do I have a dollar of gasoline in my car? And what time is practice?
I'm on Team John here because I'm the same exact way. I will say the same things to my wife. Like, oh, man, remember when we could do this? Now we can't do it. It just it's not that we don't love our life now. We just loved our life back then also.
That's right. Also. I love that. But
do you say it a little more tactfully to Emma than John says to me? Do you go to her wistfully about the life that you once had that you no longer have now?
No, usually it's when I'm really annoyed at the kids. I'm like, gosh, remember we didn't have kids and we could just do whatever we wanted?
But I see things all the time where people will talk about, you know, the stages of your life.
Sure.
Where, you know, and I'm a big believer in this stuff. Like, I've never felt like I had all the answers. But I've always leaned on people older than myself to kind of say, like, you know, where are you at in your life? And what do you wish you would have known when you were 20?
Yeah.
When I'm 20, 30, when I'm 30, you know, and I sort of ask these people those questions. And what I have gathered is, like, you know, okay, we spend our childhood years, especially the teenage years, wanting to grow up. We want to be older faster. Okay.
Yeah.
You want to get to 16 so you can drive a car.
Yeah.
You want to get to college or 18 or whatever's waiting out there for you. And then 21 so you can have a drink and go into a bar and see what that's about. You know, like you're have all these incentives to get older. And then you leave college and things get oddly, like, you suddenly realize the fun's over in a weird way.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, you're going to work, but maybe best case scenario, you're invigorated by the career you've chosen. Like, I know I was super motivated, locked in, passionate, working all the time. My friends were still going to Reno and Vegas and having fun.
Yeah.
And I was covering Little League games for a newspaper at like 25 years old. And I was running around taking myself very seriously covering these Little League games and then high school games and then college games. And then suddenly I'm covering major college and now I'm living in a new city. And so what I'm saying is, like, things just got complicated. And suddenly George Michael wasn't bebopping around and, you know, dancing and singing. And I was like, you know, taking myself very seriously. So then you become a parent.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think there's something that happens, particularly with men. Okay.
Okay.
That happens in your mid to late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And it, as you approach 50,
mm-hmm.
I think we're so much of our identity as men is centered around your job and your occupation. It comes up over and over in my conversations with other men.
Mm-hmm.
And so much is centered there. And there's a real challenge to kind of figure out what your purpose is. And then there's a question, there's a burning question in all of our minds. Is this what we're going to do for the rest of our lives?
And
it's not a good one. It's kind of like, is this it?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
It's like when you came to me one day and you said, I thought you would have amounted to more.
That's not what I said. That is not what I said.
I thought you would have been so much more. You could have been somebody.
Oh, my gosh.
You know? So I think we're all asking ourselves those questions. Like, you know, because as a kid, you go, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you say, I want to be a fireman.
Yeah.
And I want to be, you know, I want to be a farmer. I want to be a baseball player, whatever it is. And then when you hit like 45 or 50, you go, what do I want to be in the next 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, a fireman,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the thing you never got to be.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of that identity stuff going on. And I'm not saying I'm having an identity crisis, but I started to hear some of these songs, like Def Leppard was on TikTok. And all of a sudden it was like, how great were the 80s? And I was like, yeah, you know what? It was carefree.
Mm-hmm.
I was a lot more carefree.
But was the 80s greater? Was it great? I don't know. I mean, I was born in 87, so I don't really know. But like,
it's great, man.
But looking back, but like, looking, but now with all the technology we have, I mean,
that doesn't make it better.
It's some great
of the
now.
Some of the technology is not good.
No, I don't. I think the technology doesn't really make our lives better.
Yeah, Steven, Tecmo Bowl with four plays was fine. Okay. It was fine.
You don't need to yell at recruiting everybody?
It was highly entertaining. My community college football team, we had tournaments. And, you know, it was fantastic. It was like 30 guys sitting around TV cheering. We had four plays. And it was, you know, Bo Jackson against Dan Marino. And it was great. And we didn't have phones either, by the way. We had to tell each other what we were doing. We had to talk. There was no texting.
Yeah, see, that's why I'd rather do that. I don't want to talk to people.
There was some...
Technology works for you. Yeah. No, I mean, like, I want our kids, and I think everybody does this to some extent, is you are nostalgic about your own childhood. I want our kids to have the kind of childhood like I had, which is where, you know, I would get home from school and I would get my homework done or whatever, and then I'd go play. And I would be out playing, provided, you know, it wasn't raining, pouring, until dinner time. And that was it.
How'd you know when it was time to come home?
Because it got dark.
Mine was my mom yelling at the top of her lungs from like a block away. And I knew it was time.
Yeah.
And then I would run home.
Yeah.
And it's true. We were all outside.
Yeah.
We were playing. We were not playing video games because very few of us had the video games. Maybe you had an Atari.
No. Like, I had a Nintendo, but mostly, like, I wasn't fixated on it. Like, I would play it some on the weekends, but, like, I was riding my bike all over the neighborhood with friends.
They didn't have that. The companies hadn't figured out how to make it addictive yet.
But would you let your kids ride around the neighborhood on their bikes by themselves?
When they get old enough.
Not right now. The 7-year-old and 9-year-old.
No, not yet.
Like, how old do they have to be?
They were in the cul-de-sac. Like, we have a weird neighborhood because it has a hill. So I would be worried about them going down the hill. But if it were like a normal neighborhood, like where I grew up, yeah, I'd be okay with
them going. No, I think by middle school, I'd be fine with it. How about you? I'm sure you and Emma have had that.
Because my oldest is 9, and he's talked about, we live less than a mile from his school, and he's talked about how he wants to walk to school. We're like, well, you're not quite ready yet to walk to school. He's in third grade. Like, mm-hmm. just some of the stuff he does, it's like, I can't trust you to walk there, you know, like, you're going to get lost or something. So I don't...
Let him walk, and then just follow him in your car like a creeper. Like, you know what I mean? From, like, a block away.
I don't know that I want to be seen just following kids around, John. That's not my thing.
You get pulled over. What are you doing? I'm watching that kid.
That kid there? Follow him.
We all had a lot more autonomy, I think, as kids than the kids that we're raising now, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, me and my brother used to ride our bikes to, like, the school, which is over, like, you know, a little bit away, and we'd go play on the playground. Like, that's what we would do without our parents. Where, like, I could not even imagine having my kid go out there and, you know, ride his bike and go play by himself. It just seems weird.
Parents are ruining it.
Parents are ruining it.
Today. You know what? I'm going to say this.
It's my generation, I believe.
This could be like, this could be the comment that gets me like pulled off air forever.
Canceled?
Listen.
Okay, everybody, let's see.
Everyone record. Everyone hit record right now.
Settle in right now. I'm going to say this. I'm going to say this. There's a whole generation of parents right now that are guilty of overscheduling, overplanning, being too involved with their children, that have just basically thrust themselves into these games that kids used to play on the playground by themselves after school. Parents, self-absorbed, over-important, self-important, whatever you want to call it, narcissistic parents dabbling in these youth sports worlds and the after-school programs. Just let the kids figure out what to do. It's okay to come home and be like, we have nothing to do. That was a Wednesday for me. I had nothing to do, and I figured it out. My mom pointed to the door and said, you know, go out in the backyard. You know, like I was the dog. That's what we say to the dog now. Go outside. Like, my mom did that to me, and you know what? It was good for me. I got out there, I built a tree for it, and I played football, and no one else was around. I threw passes to myself, and I hit the ball off a tee and simulated a baseball game. Nowadays, parents are like, well, we have to schedule a craft activity. We have to come up with an after-school program. We have to have a parent there to supervise. No, you don't. Kids will learn conflict resolution. They'll learn how to organize themselves. We have robbed them of the ability to grow as people. We have robbed it. And then what happens? We send them off to middle school sports and high school sports, and we sit there, and when something doesn't go right, we yell, it's the coach's fault. We got to get on a new program. We got to get a new team. It's ridiculous. We are disarming our children. They are not equipped to deal with the world because of us. Parents, we're guilty. Every one of you.
That's not going to get you canceled.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's like a rally cry.
I guess I have to come back next segment.
But I think a lot of people agree with you.
How about if I say the moms are the ones responsible for
it? All right, that will get you canceled.
Have I pushed it in
absolutely.
That direction?
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, that'll get you canceled.
It's that fine line, though, John. You need to have some type of structure, though. Like, I feel like when you were a kid, and maybe even mine, I was a kid, it was just like, hey, go do whatever you want. Where now it's like, I can't do that, but I also need to be a part of their, you know, give them some type of structure, right?
Anna sent me this little thing today. I got to read it out loud. I hadn't planned on reading this, but it was from a doctor. And it said, imagine you're woken up in the morning and you're told to brush your teeth. You're told what to wear, when to eat your breakfast, what food you're eating. For the next 6 hours of your life, school, every minute is structured by somewhere else. What to read, what to look, when you can talk, when you can go to the bathroom. You come home, and then the parents go, here you go. Everything, we're going to tell you what to do all day long until you go to sleep, and then tomorrow it starts over. So too much structure. Let them be. Let them just be, and let's see what they do. Let's observe them like they're in a zoo and see what they do. They may surprise us. You know, by doing some things like we did as kids. I think we have forgotten this. And why are we afraid to let them go in the yard and then down the street and ride a bike to the school and walk to school? Because, I don't know, is it news media? Have we been conditioned that something bad's going to happen if they're out kind of walking with their friends to the playground after school? I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, that's part of it. But the reality is that those kind of crimes and kidnappings and stranger-on-stranger crimes with kids are at probably their lowest than they've ever been. So, you know, kids are safer, yeah, technically now than they have been in the past. And the point of that post that I sent you was give your kids some opportunity to make some choices and feel like they have control over their lives, because if you don't give kids some kind of control, mm-hmm, if you don't let them make some choices about how they spend their day, then they will actually be out of control.
Dan Lanning's mom and dad told me something about his childhood that is along those lines. I'll share what it is next, but I think it's an interesting idea that you might want to implement with your own family.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I meant like a eighth grade, ninth grade dance, maybe. You got it tough. I don't know. That's about where I was. That has to be like 1987-ish. I don't know. Anna, where are you? How old are you?
I'm at the Skate World in Gresham.
Steven?
I'm in my car today. This song was in the car today.
That'll take you somewhere. We should do this when we bring on guests. Like when we have Dan Lanning on this season, Trent Bray on this season, should play a song and be like, okay, where were you? Where were you when? And some of these guys are getting young. But here's the idea. Here's the idea. Dan Lanning's mother told me this. I was interviewing her. It was prior to his first season. I got on the phone with his dad and his mom, and I started asking about his upbringing. He grew up in rural Kansas City. His parents were both school teachers, and his grandparents had a farm, or they had some land. They had like 6.5 acres. And so Dan Lanning and his siblings were raised on this 6.5 acre plot of land where they had to kind of take care of things. They had chores, whatever. But the Lanning parents told me something interesting. They required the kids to make dinner once a week.
Ooh, I like that.
So the children of the Lanning family had to come up with, like, once a week. It was a set day every week. They had to make dinner. And the mom said, well, sometimes it would be hot dogs. Sometimes it would be mac and cheese. But the kids had the responsibility of planning what was for dinner and then executing it so that the parents had a night off from cooking dinner. It taught them something.
Oh, that's brilliant.
You know?
Yeah. So let's start it right now. Tonight, in fact.
I think we should just show up at the dinner table tonight and just look at the kids like, what do you got? Oh, it's your night. You didn't know that?
Pop-Tarts and Frosted Mini-Wheats for dinner it is.
You think that's... What do you think they would make?
That's exactly what they would make.
You think
topped off with some Hostess cupcakes.
You think that would be it, huh? Well, it's possible. It's possible that that could be it. But I think that's a good idea. Along the lines of what we were talking about in the last segment. It creates a little bit of autonomy for the children.
We're just working too hard to make our kids happy. That's all it is. We're doing too much to make them happy.
We care too much. We care too much.
But it's like, but we're not actually doing them a favor by trying so hard to make them happy, because that's not the reality of life. They need resilience. They need to learn about disappointment. Like, we need to be okay with our kids being bored and disappointed.
I don't remember being bored.
I don't either, but...
Steven, were you ever bored as a kid?
No, not that I can remember, because you said, it's like you just go play outside and you play shoot hoops or something, you know? Like, that's when I was bored, just like, I'm going to go shoot hoops in the driveway. Mm-hmm.
These varmints today are always bored. Have you noticed that? And what they're saying is, hey, it's your job to entertain me.
Right.
It's not my job. I think we need to stop planning activities. We need to stop putting coloring pages in front of them. We need to
like
be
you
like
did last night.
Yeah, I did it last night. They were like, "Oh, we have nothing to color," so I printed off some coloring pages, gave them to them.
Our middle child goes to pickleball.
Yeah,
right now.
Right now, she's off to pickleball. Pat is on McLaughlin Boulevard. He's got a question. Pat, go ahead. What's up, man?
Hey, John. Hi, Adam. Hey,
hi.
I was wondering, you know, Champagne Larry Scott always talked about that conferences are a bad idea, and you have mentioned it a few times on your show. Well, there was just a that came out that a bunch of college presidents and executives have floated the idea of a super football league with 80 teams in it, and you know, and bypassing the NCAA completely. You know, John, this has been coming. Well, it's been coming a long time, but it's gained steam, of course, so much with NIL and stuff. I mean, this just has to happen, don't you think? I mean, what do you think of that? And maybe what Anna thinks, because she knows so much about TV ratings and all that.
I think that the Big Ten and the SEC are already trying to do it. I have talked with at least one of those commissioners, and, you know, they were really pushing in this last round of media rights negotiations to get what they wanted and what was great for them as it pertained to the college football playoff, right? They wanted more access to the playoff. They wanted more money. They wanted a larger share. And the rest of college football kind of buckled because of what you just raised there, Pat, because of the idea, the threat that what the Big Ten and the SEC could do if they don't get what they think they deserve, they could just circumvent the NCAA and say, hey, we're going to start our own thing and we're going to take our, you know, 34 teams, maybe take our best 30. We'll take some others. I don't think it needs to be 80. But Charlie Baker has floated the idea of a division of college sports, you know, the Super League as well, that, you know, you, where you pay players, you collectively bargain. You know, it feels like it is going to head there. And then we'll have a division of college athletics that is more closely tuned in with what we know and what we knew from yesteryear. And then there'll be like kind of this semi-pro that is not quite the NFL that's happening. I don't know. I don't know if that is successful or not. The 5 at 5 is coming up. I want you to leave it right here. Hey, John Canzano here for Gresham Ford. We're talking about yesteryear. You want to talk about a good experience that will remind you of the experiences and the handshakes and the old-fashioned customer service that you used to get? Well, try Gresham Ford. If you're looking for a new or pre-owned vehicle, Bess Wills and her son Preston, they have the formula at Gresham Ford. They're going to treat you with respect. They're going to give you a fair deal. They're going to look you in the eye. They're going to shake your hand. Whether it is the technicians at the quick lane inside Gresham Ford or her sales reps on the lot, you're going to feel like you were treated fairly and given a great deal. We have, I know, because I tell you all the time, we bought a Ford Bronco and a Ford Explorer, and my sister bought a Ford and her friend bought a Ford, and I've sent so many BFT listeners to Gresham Ford because I believe in what they're doing. Bess and Preston, you'll understand when you meet them. Go to GreshamFord.com or find them on Powell Boulevard in Gresham.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I feel like I should be playing 80s music, mixing it like a DJ every segment, you know? What did you listen to music-wise back in the day? Did you listen to, like, Casey Kasem's whole thing?
Oh, yeah. I love that.
What was that lady that came on at night? Like, oh, Delilah?
Delilah.
Do you know Delilah's still around?
Yeah.
You know how I know this?
How do you know this?
Saw her on Instagram. She's on the gram. I'm on the gram. She was saying, I'm not dead. I'm still out here.
Yeah, I would call in requests to local radio stations.
You would?
Oh, yeah.
You were a caller?
That was how I spent most of my middle school years, is I would call in. They would let you recall a recorded line and leave a message.
Yeah.
And they would actually play your voice on air.
Oh, so you would sit and wait for that to be played.
With tapes in my boombox waiting to record my voice on air. Yeah.
You weren't bored.
No, I wasn't bored at all.
Steven, did you ever call into a radio show?
Never did I call in. My dad was a big radio call-in guy. Like, he would always call in for, like, contests, and he would end up winning, like, you know, prizes and stuff. Like, it'd be like, you know, what's your worst birthday experience? And he would make up some story, and then he would win, you know, gift cards somewhere.
You know, we should prank your dad sometime. We should call him and be like, hey, this is so-and-so from W, you know. And then we go, you know, we need you to say the five words, the five keywords today. And we have him get them all right, no matter what they are.
He'd love it, yeah.
We used to play a game. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, it's all you.
Your dad would love it. Let's do it. But we used to play a game on this show that was called Are You Heckling at a Sporting Event or Are You Criticizing a Hamster? Did you know that game? Have you ever heard that game?
I never. That was before my time, no.
It was before your time. And we had Chop, who would come up with the lines. And so what we did is It was whenever we were trying to do a giveaway, and we were trying to come up with a funny way to give away tickets or whatnot. And so we did this. Here's the liner that would play. Well, I got to turn the volume up on my computer. Here's the liner that would play. I was mixing 1980s songs, so I had it turned down. Okay, here we go.
And now, it's a game we here at the Bald-Faced Truth like to call Criticizing a Hamster or Heckling at a Sporting Event.
And we welcome Stephen in as the contestant on this show today. Stephen, I'm going to yell out a phrase, and you have to determine if I am criticizing my hamster or I am heckling at a sporting event. Are you ready to play?
I'm ready. Let's do this thing.
All right, Stephen, here it goes. Are you kidding me? You couldn't hit water if you fell out of a boat.
I'm going to go with criticizing an athlete. Sporting event.
No, that's wrong. That's me actually yelling at my hamster. See, the bit was, no matter what you said, you were wrong. And the listeners knew that they would never, ever get it right.
Well, some of them knew that. A lot of them called in and earnestly tried to play the game, but they would never be deemed correct.
They could never win the game.
Whatever they said they thought it was, it would be the opposite.
It's automatically wrong, no matter what you say. And Chop was pretty good at coming up with things that were ambiguous enough to be either.
Yeah.
You know, it could be that you were yelling at your hamster.
Right.
You know? Oh, you look terrible in those pants! You know?
You're just running in circles!
Yeah, that one. That was one of them.
You're just running in circles.
Yeah. And so, it was pretty...
Surely that's a hamster.
Yeah.
No. And, no.
Sorry, man.
Sorry.
No, try again. But then we would always give the tickets away. We'd be like, out of exasperation, we would just say, we've had enough. We're giving the tickets away. Forget it. Nobody got it right, but we're giving them to you. And so,
we should bring that game back.
But let's bring it back.
Yeah, let's bring it back.
But that would require, Stephen, you would have to sit around and come up with ambiguous heckles, you know?
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Sporting event. You got to think about things you'd yell at your hamster that you could also yell at, like, Bartolo Colon. You know?
All right.
Yeah.
Those are the things that work. All right, the 5 at 5. Anna's going to do it. Let's go.
The 5 at 5. Number one.
Who's Bartolo Colon? All right, the previous caller mentioned this, so I'm going to throw this into the 5 at 5 because it seems rather important.
Yeah.
A group that includes several college presidents has tabled a proposal to dramatically alter the way college football is organized. This is according to The Athletic. The group is calling themselves College Sports Tomorrow, and it's floating the idea of creating a two-tiered structure among FBS schools. So the current outline would create a system that would have the top 70 programs, all members of the 5 former major conferences, plus Notre Dame and SMU, as permanent members, and encompass all 130-plus FBS universities. The perpetual members would be in 7 10-team divisions, joined by an 8th division of teams that would be promoted from the second tier.
Oh, I like that. I like that tier system. So the teams at the bottom are playing their way into the top tier. Okay.
Yeah.
You got my attention.
Right. But I don't really think this is going anywhere for now, because apparently the ACC Board of Directors reportedly listened to a presentation for this College Sports of Tomorrow team.
Okay.
But the Big Ten, the SEC, and the Big 12 all canceled plans for a similar sit-down. They don't want to hear it.
All right. I like that they're trying. They're trying something. And by the way, Washington State and Oregon State would be included in that prior division of all the schools.
Yes.
It also solves a problem because what's going on is not sustainable. We talked about this in the opening hour. It's just not sustainable. There's no ability to, you know, you're not going to put together and pay athletes in a sustained way like what is happening now. It's not going to go on forever. It's going to bankrupt the athletic department. It's going to bankrupt the collectives. You're not going to be able to keep up. There's going to be a big division between the Big Ten, the SEC, and everybody else. And so I like that somebody's trying this. I like that it separates football from the traditional sports. I need to hear more.
Oh, but wait, there is more.
Yeah.
So this model would eliminate the so it would not only eliminate the conference structure for football, it would create one entity to negotiate with a prospective union that would represent the players on NIL, transfer portal, and salary structure.
This will happen when the SEC and the Big Ten find that it's not sustainable. Not before then. But that's the breaking point, because the Pac-12 has hit its breaking point. The Big 12 knows it's coming. The ACC knows it's coming sooner. And when the Big Ten and the SEC look around and go, hey, man, we can't do this, that's when something will happen. But the problem is they don't want to cut in everybody else. They don't want 70 schools in that top tier. They want 34. Guess what? 38 maybe? Nah. Yeah, they don't want Vanderbilt getting in on that. They don't want Rutgers getting in on that.
That's exactly the problem.
Yeah, they're going to do it, but... And I had a conversation with Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, that we talked in and around the topic. I mean, you know, he gets known as the face of the thing, but he's representing those SEC schools, and they're looking around going, why should we share? I love that someone's trying, though.
Number two.
Angel Reese declared for the WNBA draft. She did it by telling a reporter with Vogue in a profile published on Wednesday. I love that. She said, I've done everything I wanted to in college. I've won a national championship. I've gotten SEC Player of the Year. I've been an All-American. My ultimate goal is to be a pro.
Hey, y'all. So today is a really, 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 really big day for me. So basically, long story short, I'm not going to post this video until after my last game at LSU. But sadly, I have decided that I am not coming back to LSU next year, and I am going to declare for the WNBA draft. It was obviously a hard decision for me to make, but it's best for me, my career, and my family. So be happy for me or don't. I don't care.
Be happy for me, she says.
Or not. I don't care, she says.
I'm going to root for Angel Reese, because what's the point of rooting against her? I mean, I just think that I don't like some of the stuff that she has done, but I found her more likable as a losing player in this game against Iowa this week than I did as a winning player. And maybe some of it, and I'm willing to admit, like maybe some of what I didn't like about Angel Reese's act is that she was on the winning side and they were showboating, running around the court. Like, I saw a more human version of Angel Reese in her defeat. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure.
What, you don't agree? Why, I have to like her or hate her? What?
Like, why can't you like her when she's
I didn't like the
victorious.
Taunting. I don't like the taunting. It had nothing. And some people will say, oh, but you do like trash talking in the men's game, but not the women's game. It's not trash talking. It's not the, you know, Caitlin Clark's trash talking. Juju Watkins is doing a little bit of trash talking. It's not, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like the blatant pointing to the ring, bad sportsmanship. I don't see you right after I just beat you. Like, to me, that was not classy. And that's the part of it that I didn't like. It wasn't like, you know, are you trash talking between plays? I'm fine with that. But it was kind of the, I'm going to rub your nose in it and taunt you at the end that I didn't like. And I don't see that from teams that I like and respect. I just don't.
Okay.
Too much?
No.
Too soon?
Not
moving
too
on.
Soon.
Number three.
All right, let's talk about the Yankees. This is so weird to me. The Yankees are cracking down on how many chains Alex Verdugo is allowed to wear during his games. So I didn't know this. Do you know this? The Yankees have all these weird rules.
Facial hair and stuff.
Yeah, different things like this. So, like, you can have a mustache if you're a Yankees player.
They clean-cut Yankees.
You can't have more than that. And now the manager, Aaron Boone, has ordered Verdugo a maximum of one chain around his neck per game. And he says, hey, it's been kind of hard because he's used to wearing like three or four.
Throws his balance off. You know, he'll only have one chain on. Yankees. He's been stripped of all but one diamond studded necklace. He's also missing his beard. You know?
Yeah.
The Yankees put this in place 1976, George Steinbrenner. limits your hair length, bans facial hair besides mustaches. Policy's been criticized in recent years, but the Yankees play by different rules.
If you played baseball, is this something that would deter you from signing with the Yankees?
I don't think it should.
Okay.
In the end, what players want are money, playing time, exposure, and opportunity. That I can't have a beard thing is way down the list.
Shouldn't they change the rules, though? We're in 2024, man.
I don't know. I don't mind it. Like, you know,
when I was in high school,
business,
I grew my hair out playing baseball, and my coach hated it and told me to cut it, or he'd be really upset, and I didn't like him, so I kept it long. Like, I don't know. I just feel like you should be able to do what you want.
Well, you go apply for a job at Starbucks. They're going to tell you, you have to cover your midsection. You know, you
and
have
I
to have.
I think your tattoos, unless they've updated that.
You have to have closed-toed shoes on with a flat heel.
Well, I know Costco used to not be able to have tattoos shown, but now you can show off your tats.
Hmm. Let it fly.
Come on, Yankees, be like Costco.
I don't look. I don't mind. Like, they have a brand, they have a style. They you know, they're saying you can't have like a giant beard.
Makes them so unlikable. They're so unlikable in my mind.
Because they can't have beards.
Yes.
What
number four?
Ex-NFL star Vernon Davis says it's still a mystery as to how exactly his brother Vontae died earlier this week. But he's saying that the former Colts cornerback passed away following a session in a sauna. So Vontae, ex-49ers tight end, broke his silence on his little brother's death during an interview today.
He was in the sauna too long, meaning?
I don't know. Vontae was found dead inside a gym at his home in Florida on Monday. Vernon thinks that his brother either collapsed or slipped after spending time soaking in steam, but that's not really a sauna, so it's either a steam room or a sauna.
So he was in a steam room.
Outside of that, he's unsure about his brother, who was just 35 years old, how he passed away. He says he's leaning on detectives to figure it out. They're going to run tests and get back. It could be as long as a month or a month and a half until they know anything.
That's sad.
He did tell the outlet he doesn't believe drugs played a role.
You know, I got to be honest with you. I'm not a big fan of those saunas. I'm not.
Okay.
I often, when I go into those saunas,
yeah,
I'm looking around thinking, what are my exits? I'm like, I'm on an airplane and I'm checking for the emergency
exit. You think someone's going to lock you in?
No, I just think
you're going to turn into a prune.
I have a brain that goes those places. Like, what if the door doesn't open?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
It's called anxiety.
Is there somewhere that I can put my, like, is there an oxygen hole somewhere in the sauna that I'll be able to, like, breathe outside air? You know, I think all of those saunas should have those built-in safety things.
Okay.
Okay?
We don't know yet whether the sauna played a role in Vontae's death.
Well, that's where my mind went when you were reading that story.
Okay.
Number five.
I love that Victor Wembanyama's shoes are called Alien. He's got a deal with Nike, and they are set to hit the shelves. It's a really long name. It's the Nike Zoom GT Hustle 2 Alien. How many words can you throw into the name of a shoe?
Yeah.
The specific date for the drop is unknown, according to Sneaker News. They debuted as a player exclusive at the NBA All-Star Weekend back in February. They feature a green and black pattern to look like Deep Space. And they have glow-in-the-dark outsoles.
I've seen on the back, they have that kind of the alien face on the back of the shoes.
Yeah.
Like, these are Area 51 shoes.
Uh-huh.
This is kind of cool. They're retailing at $170.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not cheap. He's been referred to as an alien, obviously. LeBron gave him that title. He says he likes the alien title better than being called a unicorn.
Why don't they call him E.T.? Extraterrestrial.
Could.
You know?
Joel Embiid, in the meantime, signed a deal with Skechers. Joel Embiid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a Skechers deal?
He got a Skechers deal. And people are making fun of that, saying, oh, can't wait for his light-up shoes on the court.
Well.
But you know what? He signed what I'm sure is a multi-million dollar deal. Good for him.
I got to look this up. I got to see
these things.
And
some people are saying, you know, maybe he'll have a shoe line that is less than $170 a pair.
He's rocking the Skechers.
You know?
Good for him.
Yeah.
Is that five or we got one more?
That's five.
That's number five.
This guy kind of snuck in a 5B there.
Are you more likely to wear Joel Embiid Skechers or
Skechers?
The Wemby extraterrestrial shoes? Steven.
Well, Wemby. Wemby alien shoes for sure.
What if the Embiid shoes also get you a pass to go to your local amusement park or something like that, or your roller rink? Because they're Skechers.
No, I'll stick with the Nikes. I'll go Nike and I'll go Wembanyamas.
There you go. That'll be really cool.
I'm team Skechers. We've been buying Skechers a lot for the kids.
The kids are like, what's the big deal? What's the problem with the Skechers?
I hope Embiid Skechers last longer than the kids' Skechers.
I would think it would be really cool if they do light up, like when he's running
down
the court.
That's what I'm saying.
That'd be pretty sick, yeah.
If you're going to have glow-in-the-dark Wemby shoes, why not have light-up
shoes? Do you think the Wembanyama shoes are going to be in high demand? Because I kind of wonder positionally about Embiid and Wembanyama. Like, they're both big guys. But traditionally, the best sneaker deals have been for players who are, like, prolific scorers who play on the perimeter. Steven, Wemby's different, but do you think that the appeal of these shoes will be in line with like some of the bigger shoe deals for players who are scoring more and on the perimeter?
Now, you are right. Historically, it's a lot of guards. It's a lot of wings and forwards that can do really cool dunks. I do think Wembanyama is different, though, John, but I think a lot of it is going to come down to, do the Spurs end up winning, right? Like right now, he's just putting up monster numbers that are just insane that we've never seen for a 20-year-old. Like the other night against Nikola Jokic, MVP, he almost went for a quadruple-double. He had 8 assists, 9 blocks, along with 15 rebounds, 23 points. Like, that's stuff we don't see. So I think if he starts winning and he's still putting up these type of numbers, I do think, like, his shoe line can become super popular because he's going to be the best player in the NBA. But it has to go along with winning to be a big guy at that point.
You're closer to this than we are because you've got boys. What is the shoe that everybody wants right now? What are the kids wearing? Like, you know,
my son really wanted the Luka Doncic's, and he has some of those. Those are Nikes. So he wanted the Lukas, and I'm sure he'll want some Wembanyamas. Like he's grown up like watching him on YouTube when he first started watching basketball. Like he saw all the highlights of Victor, and now he sees him in the NBA. So I think he will want a pair of those.
The Jaws are popular too. Ja Morant shoes.
I think they were until he got caught with guns all the time. I think then parents kind of poo-pooed it a little bit.
You buy a pair, you actually get a gun.
Yeah, free gun.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I know.
Toy gun.
I was in high school when the first Jordans came out, and I remember people would like couple kids had them, and I don't think they were like stupid expensive at that time compared to like today. I would be curious what the price was, but I never got a pair. My parents were not springing for that. Like, they weren't going to make that purchase. Like, it would have been a whole conversation that I would have had with my parents that I wasn't willing to have at that age to get those sneakers. Because I can remember buying, like, regular Nikes.
Yeah.
They were $40. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, like, my grandpa going, $20 each, you know, like, for the shoes. Mm-hmm. Because before that, that's what we bought. Like, we bought cheap shoes.
Yeah.
And so I look back and I go, gosh, I should have been loading up on those Jordans. What are they worth today, Steven? The Jordan ones.
I mean, thousands.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands.
I should have got one in every size. Time machine. That's what I need. That's all I need. All right. Leave it here. They are talking about changes to the NCAA tournament again in a different way. We'll talk about it next.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, they're proposing changes to the NCAA format. I am going to get into that, and it's not the changes we've been talking about. We have talked about changes to the number of teams. We've talked about changes to, you know, adding more of the middling major teams. I wrote about this over the weekend, but now it is apparently becoming official. The NCAA's vice president of women's basketball is a person named Lynn Holtzman. She, by the way, was kind of at the center of everything that was going on with the three-point line fiasco that happened in Portland at the regional. Lynn Holtzman was kind of running the interference behind the scenes, checking with the NCAA spokespeople, and so she was all over that. But she is the vice president of women's basketball for the NCAA. She is saying that they are going to reevaluate whether they should have two sites in the Portland, like in the NCAA tournament, they had Portland and Albany as regional sites, two sites with four brackets, but two sites. That she's talking now, saying that they are going to have a review of that. They have enough data to consider some changes. And I am expecting and anticipating that they are going to talk about perhaps going to four regionals for the women's tournament, which feels like it should be the same as the men's tournament. Like, I get what they did. They did it in the wake of the pandemic. Problem being, the next 2 years, there are only supposed to be two regional sites. So there's a real chance here that I think next year's sites are Birmingham, Alabama, and Spokane, Washington. I think there's a real chance that the NCAA comes out and says, okay, we're going to do two additional sites, and they will be San Jose, California, just spitballing here, and Kansas City. Like, they, you know, they could do that, and they could go to four sites. In the men's tournament, they have four regional sites. In the women's tournament, they have two. There's supposed to be two for the next 2 years. Bids are already out for 2027 and 2028 for the regionals. Portland has submitted bid requests for those two tournaments. So, and I do expect Portland's going to get a regional in 2027 and or 2028. So keep an eye on that. The NCAA tournament on the men's side, not asking the same questions that they are asking on the women's side. Keep in mind, mispainted three-point line, removal of a referee at halftime of a game. Utah had to change team hotels. Notre Dame's Hannah Hidalgo missed a couple minutes of the game against Oregon State. She was being forced to remove a nose ring that she had wore all season, rather. So a lot to be talked about on the women's side of the bracket in the tournament. But, Stephen, a move from four sites to two sites, now going back to four. Does it matter?
I think to me it does not matter that much, but I do think in the women's game, if they're going to do it, they need to do it now, right? Like presently into next season, because they need to build on the momentum of what they've gotten out of this NCAA tournament. Like, you can, you know, we've been talking a lot about the women's tournament this year, where I feel like in years past it hasn't been the talking point. So you got to build on that momentum and you got to see what you can do. I do. It's one of those things. Also, I fear, though, John, that if they go to too many and they go to four regional sites, is it going to be one of those situations where you see a team build a new stadium and they make the stadium too big, and then the fans aren't as big as a big of a factor? I feel like two is awesome because, you know, obviously you get more fans there, more everything in there, but I don't know. I do wonder about the women's tournament going forward when they don't have Caitlin Clark, when they don't have Angel Reese. Like, I do think it's fine, and they'll have some really good players still. You know, Juju Watkins is going to be there, obviously, and there's going to be some, you know, other women that come in. But I do still question this, the popularity. Can they continue the momentum going forward? So two, I think, is great and is going to work. We know it works. Four, I think, is taking a little bit of a risk, but if you're going to do it, you got to do it now.
Yeah, the reason you'd go to four is, you saying that the events split in, you know, quarters, the tournament split into quarters is still going to draw enough fans and enough interest. They moved to two regional sites with eight teams at each regional site for the Sweet 16. That they moved to that because they thought, okay, we'll layer it, and now you won't just have Gonzaga fans and USC fans and Duke fans coming to Portland. You'll also have North Carolina State fans. You'll have Texas fans. And so they really layered the event. Now, it's been successful. And I mentioned this, you know, last week and into this week that a lot of people were criticizing, outsiders, national media members were criticizing Portland and Albany as those two sites, saying, hey, the tournament's outgrown these two sites. What they should have been saying is, hey, the tournament can stand on its own with four sites. Because here's what I think is going to happen. If they go to four tournament sites for a regional and the women's tournament, I think Portland's going to participate all the time. I think we're going to get this event all the freaking time, because I think now you're looking at like the same type of cities are going to bid for this. You're not going to see Chicago, New York, L.A. bidding on the women's regional. No, they're going to want the final four. So the women's regional is still going to go to markets like Portland, and I think go to Portland in a way that, like, hey, you got proof of performance. You got a viable building. You obviously have done a great job in putting on this event in 2019 and again here in 2024. So I think Portland is going to be in play no matter what. And I actually think going from two to four benefits Portland, because now you have double the sites and Portland's still a really good candidate.
Do you think, though, there's still going to be the fan excitement to have four regionals and have it be good crowds once this group of women, you know, leave to go to the WNBA?
No, because I think it will hurt attendance at the four sites versus two. Because I think, you know, in 2019, Sabrina Ionescu in Oregon were in the Portland regional. South Carolina was in the Portland regional. The Ducks beat South Carolina to advance to the Final Four that year. The attendance that year versus this year with eight teams at Moda Center was up 20% this year. So I think it was almost exclusively because there was double the number of teams and also a little glow with Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese. Even though they were in the other bracket, I still think the glow came to Portland with it, because the games themselves felt bigger, felt more important. We knew more about the teams. I think that continues. But I kind of was, at first glance, I was like, oh, this is a knock on Portland and Albany. And then I started thinking about it, and I reached out to Sport Oregon, and I asked Sport Oregon, because they're the entity that puts the bid together. And I said, the bids are in already for 2027 and 2028. The question is, are they picking two sites or picking four? But I asked them, I said, are you bidding against larger cities now? You know, given that the women's tournament has expanded its reach and its viewership, are you seeing like Chicago and New York and Atlanta in there versus maybe what you used to see, which is Columbus, Tampa, Portland, Sacramento, Spokane? And they said, no, we're seeing the same cities. So it's not like bigger cities are bidding on those four regions. It's just there's going to be four regions, I think. I think they'll move to four. And I think, you know, they'll look to move to four, and I think Portland will participate regularly in the regional. Let's play some Punch It.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
NBA playoffs ahead. Zach Lowe talking about the play-in teams. Are they dangerous? He thinks so, with a caveat. Punch It. Steven, I'm frozen up over here. You can grab Zach Lowe's cut. Western play-in teams.
You're eighth, right? That's where their seat is. All of this depends on where the big Serbian bully hovering over the entire Western Conference ends up. If they're one, if Denver's one, the eighth seed is goodbye. If you get one of these other teams, Oklahoma City or Minnesota, unproven young team. I love the Thunder, but they're unproven. The Wolves haven't won a playoff series in a long, long time. You can talk yourself into, hey, maybe it's 2-2. If it's Denver at one, everything starts from where Denver is seated and flows from there.
Denver, dangerous, looking dominant. Everything flowing from there. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. But the play-in tournament or the play-in event was greeted with a lot of enthusiasm last year. I'm eager to see this year, if you're talking about Lakers, Warriors, it's got some star power, or if you're talking about Bulls, Hawks, or whoever you're talking about, I'm curious to see if that narrative will continue. Stephen, your vote, will the play-in event be viewed the same as it was a year ago, where people said, hey, this is kind of cool?
Yeah, I think so, especially in the Western Conference, because right now it's the Kings, it's the Suns, it's the Lakers and Warriors. I mean, if you're getting the Suns, Lakers, Warriors in a one-game play-in type of game where you lose, you're eliminated, I think people will be watching, people will be locked into those games with all that star power going on. So, yeah, I think definitely the Western Conference. And I'm with Zach Lowe on this. Like, as long as you don't face Denver, you got a chance against Minnesota, OKC. So it's going to be important and interesting to see how the end of the season goes if teams are really trying to position for what ranking they get in the Western Conference.
Milwaukee Bucks sitting at the 2 spot in the Eastern Conference. Doc Rivers not happy, though, as the Bucks lost to the Wizards on the road last night. Here's Doc. Punch it.
You know, it's funny. I've actually been sitting back and watching everything. Not just our players, but our tribal crew, everything. And I've made a lot of notes. I will say that. I won't share that. But we don't bring the necessary professionalism, seriousness on the road. And that's something that we can fix. That's something we're going to have to fix.
Bucks were a 12.5-point favorite, lost the game. On the road this season, they're 18-20, which, you know, it's not embarrassing. You know, there may be a couple of games upside down where you know, they should be 500 or better on the road. They're good enough.
Losing to the Wizards is embarrassing.
Yeah, but
is that Doc says you can fix that. We're 75 games into the season. Can you fix that? Seven games left?
The question I had is he talking about players or the travel crew? Like
both?
He says he's not gonna name names, but he kinda throws everybody under the bus, so to speak, like literally, the bus. I don't know if you can fix that at this point, because that's your culture. It's kinda who you are. But I think right now everybody in the East is it Boston or bust?
Yeah, I think it's Boston or bust. The only wild card is Embiid's back for Philadelphia. Can he get healthy enough by the playoffs? They'd be the other team, but I think it's Boston or bust right now in the Eastern Conference.
Bronny James in the portal, out of the portal. LeBron James was asked about it. Punch it.
Report that Bronny potentially in the transfer portal.
Well, I don't know where it came from, but at the end of the day, Bronny's his own man. He has some tough decisions to make, and when he's ready to make those decisions, he'll let us all know. But as his family, we'll support whatever he does.
Support what he does. He's his own man. Doesn't have his coach, Andy Enfield, leaving USC for SMU.
You buy that? LeBron's going to stay out? Let Bronny make the choice?
No. Not for a second. I think Bronny should stay in college. I think he should change his name, go into witness protection, and emerge somewhere. We'd be like, that guy's a really good player. Like, I actually think Bronny James is, in some ways, I appreciate his game more because I know the scrutiny, the pressure that he's under, all of that. But he's got a nice game. Like, he's a good defender. He's a good passer. He doesn't look to score, and he doesn't physically overpower other players. And he's not, like, a lights-out shooter. But he does a lot of things that don't show up in the box score that can keep him on the floor for a team in college that wins games.
Yeah, I think he can be a winning player. Like you said, very smart player when he's out there on the court. It's just there's so much pressure on him. He can't do anything right. Like, he's never going to live up to expectations, and that is too bad. Like, if he could change his name, if his name was John Smith, they'd be like, you know, there's a good little player on the portal. Let's go get that guy.
Yeah, I could see Bronny James at Oregon, and he's exactly the kind of player that Dana Altman needed this season. Like, the depth that he could have added as a player, a rotation player, maybe he's the eighth player in your rotation. Like, he's a good college player, but he's not generational. You know, he's not going to be a lottery pick in a good draft. You know, this year's draft, not so good, though. Charles Barkley making a plea to players.
These guys out here making up excuses, talking about the NFL, the NBA, we're in bed with all the gambling sites. 100% true. Under no circumstance, as a player, should you talk to your friends about gambling, shade points, good or bad, prop bets as a player, you can never, ever, ever entertain betting on your own, influence the outcome of a game. That, like I say, don't make excuses, man. Hey, sports gambling is a big thing. It's going to be there no matter what. But as a player, and I'm talking just to the players, under no circumstances can you get yourself in a situation where you are involved with gambling at the point where you can fix a game, beat some type of stupid prop bet. Guys, I'm just telling you, don't ever do that because you're going to get banned for life if you do that, period.
Yeah, Charles Barkley making a plea for players who are potentially throwing away tens and 20s and $30 million worth of future revenue because they want to place a prop bet somewhere. It's insanity. It makes no sense. The fact that he has to say it is alarming, but I'm glad somebody's saying it who's played in the league. The Ducks' future next season in the Big Ten Conference and their thinking as it pertains to the college football playoff. What should it be? We'll cover it next in the next segment. What should they be thinking about? What should Dan Lanning be thinking about? Is the goal for Oregon to make the playoff? Rattle around the playoff? Win the playoff? What is the goal if we're putting it on paper for the Oregon Ducks next season? Leave it here. We'll talk about it next.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
University of Oregon will be moving on to the Big Ten Conference to play football next season. And, of course, we've had a lot of discussion about, you know, what that will mean for ticket sales at Autzen Stadium. They're up about 10,000 on season tickets that were inquiries for season tickets this year at Oregon. I'll get some more accurate figures, more recent figures as the season approaches. But a lot of discussion nationally about what the expectations for Oregon should be. Josh Pate talking here in this podcast clip about Oregon's expectations for next season, the Big Ten, the college football playoff. How should the Ducks be thinking about this? What are the expectations for Oregon? Here's Pate.
Oregon's a whole lot closer to the top than even the middle of the pack there. They've got the second best odds to win the Big Ten this year. So the mentality, rightfully so, should be immediately compete for the Big Ten. Immediately, certainly contend for an expanded playoff spot. They were already thinking that way last year. But the other part of that is Oregon's not going to be a, hey, let's hope to make the playoff sort of roster and sort of fan base. They're going to be a, we recruit all these guys, we portal in all these guys, we should be making noise in the playoffs, shouldn't we? And yes, you should.
Should be making noise. The thing that I pump the brakes on with Josh Pate is I think things happen in stages for teams, for people, for programs. We see things happen in stages, generally. There are outliers. There are get-rich-quick stories that are out there. But Oregon's trajectory is pointed in the right direction. But what I haven't seen from Oregon is a breakthrough moment that suggests to me that they're capable of winning a conference championship. Like, I am a little leery right now. Maybe 6 weeks ago, I said I thought Oregon could win the Big Ten. In that time, Chip Kelly has joined Ryan Day's staff. We've seen another assistant coach from Oregon leave to join Ryan Day's staff. I'm looking at Oregon versus Ohio State, and I'm saying to myself, gosh, Oregon's got all the players it needs to compete against Ohio State. The question will be, and people aren't talking about this yet, the question will be, can Dan Lanning and his staff stand toe-to-toe with Ryan Day and his staff? That's the chess match. And it's an important one because what have we seen in Dan Lanning's early career? We've seen him win games. I thought he had a great first season. I thought he had a better second season. I'm eager to see what he's going to do in this third season, but I haven't yet seen him beat Washington when it mattered. 0-3 in those games. He split with Oregon State. That's not Ohio State. That's Oregon State. And so I'm a little leery with making the playoff. Yes, I think Oregon's going to make the playoff. I think especially an expanded playoff, I think Oregon will participate frequently in the playoff. But I need to see a little growth, more growth from Dan Lanning and his staff. I need to see them win a game that nobody thinks they're going to win. I need to see him out-coach somebody. I was a little concerned with the performance in the Pac-12 championship game. Felt like Oregon had taken a step back and Kalen DeBoer and Washington had taken a step forward. Like, I think there was just a little bit, you know, maybe Washington was just better. But there was some coaching, certainly in play in that first matchup with Washington, that didn't go Oregon's way. Oregon should have won that game. Meanwhile, Oregon tight end Terrence Ferguson talking here about staying at Oregon and Dan Lanning's trajectory. I love this quote. Listen to this.
Oh, that's huge, man. You know, he's a great coach. He's obviously had the opportunities to go other places, and to come back here where we have a really good team and, you know, we're building something special, it just means a lot when a guy like that comes back and really is committed to the team.
All right. I think Lanning has helped himself in a number of ways. He's done a lot of smart things. How he has handled kind of that outside question of are you in has been nothing short of brilliant. He has sent a message to his players, to fans, to media, to opposing teams, to recruits that says, I'm here. I'm about this. I'm building something. I'm so excited to be here. There's nowhere else I'd rather be. And that has, I think, manifested itself in like a lot of focus at Oregon. The next thing we need to see, though, is we need to see him beat Michigan, beat Ohio State, win a big game or two next season.
Does it have to be next season?
I think he needs a step forward next season. And the step forward is not a 10-win season. I think it's you got to beat somebody that comes with pedigree. He needs a big win.
It's the class of the win, right? Like they need that headline victory that they haven't had yet.
And I'm not saying he has to win the Big Ten and he has to go and win the playoff, win the national championship. I'm not saying that at all. I think that's too much to ask next season. But we need to believe that Oregon can win a national championship after next season. Like, we need to believe that it's possible, it's conceivable. We need to be able to see that. And in order to see that, I need to see him beat somebody. Because beating a North Carolina team in a bowl game or getting to a Fiesta Bowl and running Liberty out of the stadium, it's not enough, you know. And it sounds like I'm nitpicking, but I need something of the caliber of getting past Washington, although Washington's going to take a step back. We're back tomorrow with another great show. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.